Chapter 5.
It's just that your appointment isn't on the schedule, you see.
The clerk pointed a damning finger at a blank spot on his parchment,
and if it's not on the schedule, it doesn't happen.
Perhaps under normal circumstances, but this is of the utmost importance, said Knight Commander Urthos, stepping up to the podium. I'm sure you understand. The young clerk wore an expression that suggested otherwise, along with the dull robes of an apprentice of the Order of the Moon.
You have to have an appointment, he repeated with dim certainty.
Gorm grit his teeth, but he held his tongue. The party waited in the main chamber of Vetchel's Tower of Magi, which was far too public a place for a group of outlaws to make a scene. There were few things that could unite the Order of the Sun and the Order of the Moon. Over the ages, the two great factions of mages had refined their philosophical differences into the purest contrarianism. Solomancers and Noctomancers went to great lengths to be on the opposite sides of every debate, be it political, social, religious, or inane. Even amid such cultivated animosity, however, there were still forces that could push the two orders of mages to the brink of cooperation. One common example was real estate prices. To fulfill their sacred duty of safely identifying and training Arth's magically gifted, the two great orders needed to have bases of operations in all of Arth's major cities. Yet proper mage towers were incredibly expensive, especially those built to withstand the punishment of apprentices inexpertly fiddling with the primal energies of the universe. As such, most of Arth's small to mid-sized cities had a single Tower of Magi shared by both the Order of the Sun and the Order of the Moon. Within the walls, however, the orders didn't share much as far as Gorm could see. The floor was neatly bisected by an inlaid silver line, and the mages on either side of it were sorted by the colors of their robes. Unfortunately, the two orders had come together in appointing the world's most useless apprentice to man the front desk.
"I am the Knight Commander of the City Guard," hissed Tyran. "Everybody needs an appointment," repeated the apprentice. "Perhaps tomorrow morning."
As satisfying as it was to watch the Knight Commander wrestle with a fellow gatekeeper to bureaucracy, Gorm was in a hurry to be away from the crowds.
"Maybe we could try somewhere else, lad," he offered.
Tyran tapped the packet of paperwork. "These forms are no good without secondary witnesses or proof. This was your wizard's idea of the fastest way to get that, so perhaps he could help," the Knight Commander added pointedly. Jin looked at Gorm with reluctance, but they had few options and less time. The dwarf nodded.
"Very well," said Jin. The Noctomancer stepped forward and threw back his long cloak, revealing the ornate purple robes he wore beneath them. "I know the hour is late, apprentice, but I must insist that you make an exception and take us to the Chamber of Owls."
Recognition flashed in the apprentice's eyes, burning away the disinterested Patina and leaving something akin to fear in its wake.
Yes, High Counselor, just one moment.
"Well, I didn't expect it to go that well."
Gorm watched the young mage scurry away.
"I am still a high counselor, and most Noctomancers will defer to me," said Jin softly, nodding to the young mage, "at least when I can sneak onto the Order's premises."
"I'm surprised they let you keep your title after, you know," said Gorm.
"Oh, I've lost all responsibilities and much of the privilege," said Jin. "And I'm sure that some ambitious wretch has taken my seat at the head of the Circle of the Red Hawk by now. But I still command the same spells, have the same mastery of magic, and know the same academy secrets, and so I remain a high counselor."
"It's just that now your title is more about sizing you up as a threat," Gorm observed.
"It always was," said Jin with a shrug. "Unskilled apprentices are a threat to society. Fully recognized mages are a threat to the Academy's enemies, and high counselors and archmages are a threat to each other."
"Sounds like being a professional hero. I just never realized you were so high up."
Gorm watched another mage give the Noctomancer a low bow.
"I must admit, I've missed this," conceded Jin as the apprentice came rushing back. The young man guided them upstairs to the Chamber of Owls, a perfect circular room at the center of the tower. The walls were black and shining near the door that Gorm stepped through, decorated with silver stars and comets. Across the room he could see a plain door marked with a golden sun surrounded by an alabaster wall. The walls on either side were a mosaic of gray stones arranged so that the room shifted seamlessly from day into night. The floor of the room was almost entirely occupied by a wide basin as high as Gorm's waist and filled with a shimmering silver liquid. Several noctomancers and solomancers stood around the pool, brought together by some indeterminate task, and united in shock at seeing an apprentice lead a party of adventurers into the chamber.
"What is the meaning of this?"
demanded the noctomancer with the fanciest robes. Her face was sharp, pale to the point of ghastliness, and framed by long locks of ebony hair, frosted white at the tips.
"We've come to use the scrying pool, Counselor of Owls," said Jin.
A collective gasp rose from the mages and a couple of the heroes at the mention of the pool. The noctomancers and solomancers from the tower erupted in immediate protest, but Jin countered with shouted procedures,
"I am declaring an emergency with the authority of a high counselor, set forth in..."
Gorm leaned close to Laruna.
"What's a scrying pool?" he muttered.
"It's an omnimancer relic, a powerful tool for divination," said the solomancer.
"Ah, thank you."
Gorm recalled that omnimancers had once worked with the Sten to build artifacts of incredible power, unreproducible with modern magic. He wasn't sure what these relics actually did, save that they usually required both halves of magic to operate properly. Another question came to Gorm's mind.
"And what's divination?"
Laruna seemed surprised at the question.
"Do you know anything about magic?"
"I try not to," said Gorm. "The only thing I learned about wizards is how to beat the tar out of them."
"Huh," Laruna said without amusement as she rubbed her jaw. "Divination lets us see things from across space and time. A scrying pool lets you see anything within 100 miles as clearly as if you were in the room. The omnimancers made hundreds or thousands of them, but they were all supposed to have been destroyed or sealed away years ago."
"So why do these mages have one then?" said Gorm.
"I don't know," Laruna admitted. "I've never been in a Chamber of Owls before."
"It may work out for us," interjected Caitha. "Listen." Knight Commander Urthos sauntered forward to examine the pool, eyed warily by Vetchel's mages.
"I'm fairly certain this is an illegal artifact," he said, hiking up his breeches for emphasis in the manner of guardsmen everywhere.
"We have full authorization to run a scrying pool, and we take our citizens' privacy seriously."
The Counselor of Owls looked like a cornered rat.
"Does that mean you aren't scrying on people in the city?" asked Tyron.
"Only when necessary," offered one of the solomancers working the chamber.
"And I suppose you're the same group who says it's necessary," pressed Tyron.
"King Clan of Ruskin has authorized the Academy of Mages throughout the kingdom to take steps to ensure the safety of the Ruskin people,"
recited the Counselor of Owls.
"And he said scrying pools. He gave you permission to scry on his own subjects," asked Tyron.
"We can't be certain that he didn't mean that," said the counselor.
"What we can be certain of is how the public and town elders might react to my report on the matter," said the knight commander. "Unless, of course, you were to use it in defense of our city and nation."
"And there it is," said the counselor of owls.
"We've received word that a great threat approaches from the south," said Tyron, "and we need proof to confirm the warning and mobilize our defenses."
"And finalize your claim paperwork as well, I'd imagine," said the counselor. "I suppose if we don't help, you'll run off to tell the town about the scrying pool."
"Let's not discuss such formalities when the threat is so great."
Gorm noticed that Tyron didn't specify which threat. The Counselor of Owls seemed to pick up on that as well.
"Fine,"
sighed the old Noctomancer, signaling to the other mages. With scowls and grumbles, the Noctomancers and Solomancers shuffled into position.
"And where is this alleged army?"
Gorm raised a hand.
"Due south. It took us about 4 days of marching to get here from where we spotted them. The undead don't sleep, but they don't move fast either.
The undead? Very well, said the counselor, now a little more serious.
At her signal, the mages channeled weaves of solomancy and noctomancy into the scrying pool. Silvery light and dark shadows danced across its surface, coalescing into moving shapes. A moment later, Gorm could clearly see the Chamber of Owls as though viewed from above, complete with an image of himself staring down into the pool. He could even see Bert leaning out of his rucksack to get a better vantage.
"Back in the bag before someone sees," he whispered.
The kobold noticed himself and ducked back into the rucksack with a muttered curse.
"Take a shot," said the Counselor of Owls.
Gorm could make out light blue threads of air among the weaves as the noctomancers around the scrying table adjusted their spellcasting. The image within the pool seemed to drop away, and another floor filled with wizards and mages fell over it, followed by several more, and then the tower's roof. The tower and surrounding buildings shrank as the scrying pool's vantage rose higher above Vetchel, stopping only when the city below was a mosaic of rooftops with cobblestone cracks running through it.
"South?"
said the Counselor of Owls. The buildings and streets in the scrying pool began to move as the solomancers around the relic added strands of fire and water into their weaves. Gorm felt his stomach drop as his eyes told him that he was soaring over a silver city and moving faster every moment. The walls of Vetchel flew past, and before long they were soaring over southern Ruskan. The fields and forests looked an irregular quilt, with roads and rivers for seams. As they soared along, however, the features of the landscape began to run together like eggs with their yolks popped. Bubbles started drifting to the surface of the pool, popping into small, wispy clouds of steam.
"Remember your virtues," chided the Counselor of Owls.
"Are they having shameful thoughts?" Gorm muttered to Laruna.
"What? No!" hissed the Solomancer. "Why would they be thinking about things like that now?"
"How should I know?" said Gorm. "I can't ever think of a reason that you tall folk are ever thinking shameful things, but I'll be thrice cursed if you ever stop."
The Solomancer sputtered. "We don't... I mean, people like Heraldin, yeah, but why would you even bring that up?"
"The Owl Lady had to remind them about their virtue,"
Gorm nodded to the Noctomancer guiding Vetchel's mages. Laruna rolled her eyes.
"The Counselor of Owls was reminding them of a mage's virtues. That's different."
"Like only using magic for good?"
"See, that's how it's different. You'll find teachings on good and evil in the temples, but a mage's virtues are power and mastery," said Laruna. "And balance, technically, when it comes to omnimancy. Most mages don't need help remembering that they want power and mastery. But when you're working with old omnimancer relics, you have to mind all three."
Gorm scratched his beard.
"So, they're throwing too much solomancy or noctomancy at it?"
"Well, they were." Laruna nodded at the silvery image. "Look, they're bringing it back into balance."
The solomancers around the scrying pool were increasing the power and complexity of the weaves they sent into the edges of the silver basin, while the noctomancers were pulling their own magic back a bit. As the mages of the two orders approached equilibrium, the picture within the pool came into focus once more.
"There," said Jin, pointing at the pool.
Amid the roiling bubbles in the boiling pool, distant figures were moving over the plains. They looked no bigger than toy soldiers, but even from far above, their shambling gaits and bloodied clothes were, for lack of a better term, dead giveaways. A collective gasp rose from the assembled mages.
"The undead,"
whispered the Counselor of Owls.
"Aye," said Gorm, "an army of them, coming for your gates."
"Gods above," said Tyron. There were only a handful at first, but scattered groups and then entire squads of the walking dead slid into view as the mages pushed the scrying pool ever farther. Wraiths, ghosts, and carrion birds flew over the army, looming larger than life in the silvery surface of the pool.
"It is the army of the Lich D'Tar Ermion," Jin said, watching ranks of dead men lurch together in ragged formations.
The Counselor of Owls was startled at the name.
"Ermion, a lich, are you sure?"
One specter flew closer to the pool's vantage point, slipping into their view like a ghastly whale gliding beneath a ship. The ghost turned over as it flew, as if to look up at the scrying pool's invisible eye, and for a moment the boiling pool was filled with a giant skeletal visage.
"I am regrettably certain," Jin stared stoically down at the pool, "and with every day he draws nearer to Vetchel."
"How long do we have?" asked the Knight Commander, his face pale to the point of translucence. Gorm shook his head.
3 or 4 days. 5 if the river slows their progress.
"Then we've lost too much time already," said the Counselor of Owls.
The picture in the scrying pool winked out as the mages powering it scrambled into action. Some began discussing their next steps, while others didn't wait before rushing off, already bellowing orders to apprentices. Knight Commander Urthos marked a few checks on his form, solicited a signature from the Counselor of Owls, and made for the door with barely a wave to Gorm and his party.
"And with that," Caitha muttered in Gorm's ear, "I think our work here is done."
"Aye," he agreed. "It's best we move on before—"
"Leaving so soon,"
said the Counselor of Owls, her hand clamping down on Gorm's shoulder like a bony vice.
"You and I still haven't had a chance to chat, Gorm Ingerson."
Gorm felt his stomach drop at the mention of his name.
Who?
"Don't,"
said the Counselor sharply.
"Come, we will speak in my office." "Come in, come in."
The Counselor of Owls ushered Gorm's party into a large room near the top of the tower, windowless and drab. Old bookshelves lined the walls, each straining under the weight of ancient grimoires and stacks of parchment. A simple desk sat in the middle of the violet carpet, empty save for a quill in the inkwell, a nameplate that read Devaya Ermanal, and the requisite skull set near the corner. The Counselor looked at the party standing in her chambers with condescending amusement, like a swamp drake contemplating a lost farm animal.
"And now, Gorm, I think we should have a frank talk."
"You can start by telling me how you know who I am," said Gorm.
The sorceress shrugged.
"Your face is your unwanted posters from here to Silvershore."
"Drake spit," snapped Gorm. "Those posters give nothing away. The Knight Commander of the City Guard didn't even notice the resemblance."
The Counselor of Owls' laughter was like a subterranean pool, dark, cold, and deep.
"Oh, I wouldn't hang your case on the competence of our Knight Commander."
"We're hanging it on the incompetence of your woodcut artist," said Gorm. "Those portraits look nothing like us."
"They barely look like people," added Haraldin under his breath.
"Fair enough. The truth is that I recognized you because you've made a name for yourself lately by traveling with an old acquaintance of mine."
The Noctomancer turned and smiled at Jin, earning him sidelong glances from the other heroes and an open scowl from Laruna.
"I'm afraid you have the advantage, madam," said Jin, his brow furrowing. "I've had few dealings with the Ruskin branches of the Order."
"I met you well before you were in the Academy, before you walked or spoke. Perhaps this will refresh your memory."
The Counselor picked up a sheaf of paper and tossed it into the air with one hand, and with the other made a quick gesture. The air around the page shimmered with a faint whispering noise, and the page was reduced to a flurry of scraps in seconds.
"Your Aya of Blades," said Jin.
"Hello again, Jin,"
said Aya. Gorm started at the name. Aya of Blades was one of the 5 mages behind the Leviathan Project, along with Wynn Cinder, Telder of Umbrax, Azanon the Black, and Datar Ermion. The wizard sputtered as he stared, but I assumed...
"That I was dead,"
said Aya.
"A useful rumor encouraged by one Devaya Ermanal. I'm sure you are familiar with using an alias by now. I faked my death and left the Leviathan Project after Azanon found his doom. If I hadn't, I'd likely have met the same fate."
Gorm flinched at the mention of the Spider King. He still remembered running from the quest that ended his former career.
"You were scared the guild would send a hero like Johan to run you through."
Aya of Blades shot him an inscrutable look.
"No,"
she said,
That became a concern after Johann killed Dutar, but I was already re-enrolled in the academy under a new name.
But surely someone must have tracked you down through all these years, said Gorm.
They did.
Aya dusted a couple of paper scraps from her sleeve.
They regretted it.
Ah!
Gorm winced as he looked at the sad pile of shredded parchment on the floor.
An unfortunate necessity, but we do what we must. Self-preservation and all,
said Aya brightly.
Speaking of which, that's why I've brought a gaggle of renegade heroes into my room and told them my little secret.
I'm not sure I follow, said Lorona.
I'm sure she'll be telling us about an errand she had planned for us, said Gorm.
Close, said Aya. I want to help you do what you're already doing, and now that you know who I am and what I worked on, you know I can help you defeat Dutar Ermion.
There was a hiss and a rustle as the assembled adventurers took a synchronized, deep breath and leaned back in unison, wearing faces that ranged from alarmed shock to awkward winces.
We're not going to fight a lich, said Caitha.
Not again, anyway, said Laruna. Even Geist shook his head, if ever so slightly. Aya shrugged off their protests.
Oh, don't bother playing at this. You will.
Why would we do that? Asked Heraldin. It'd be suicide by dark magic.
Which is why you need my help, said Aya.
The senior Noctomancer waved her hand, and a set of drawers against the far wall suddenly shifted down the face of their filing cabinet, as though sliding into the floor. When each drawer reached the bottom, it disappeared with a gleam of sorcery. As the drawers scooted out of existence, a single drawer slid in from a similar spatial distortion at the top of the cabinet, slowing as it glided into place. Opening the single drawer, Aya produced a folio of loose documents.
I have information on the artifacts we used for the Leviathan project, said Aya, leafing through the folder. Who found them, what they were used for, notes from any experiments, and most importantly, where they are today. You'll need at least one if you're to stop Dutar.
You're presuming too much, said Gorm. We've already risked our necks to do as much as we have.
Exactly,
snapped Aya, looking up from her documents.
You could have left Vechel to its fate, just as I intend to once this conversation is over. You could have fled, but instead you risked capture by the guild for the sake of a gaggle of serfs and fools. And it's because you're all... What's the word?
She asked, snapping her fingers.
Good?
Said Caitha. Aya shook her head.
I don't like to be so binary.
Noble?
Suggested Heraldin. The Lady of Blades looked over Gorm in his muddy, road-worn armor with a critical eye.
No, that's not it,
she said.
Honorable?
Said Laruna.
Simple. Predictable. It's some combination of all of them.
Aya waved away the verbal conundrum and walked over to retrieve an expensive-looking crystal from a shelf.
The point is, we all know you're going to face the Lich, and we don't have time to pretend otherwise.
I ain't pretending, said Gorm. Now that we've warned the city...
Do we really have to do this?
Aya rolled her eyes as she set the crystal on her desk.
Very well. I could happily live out my days on an ice floe knowing I was the last living person on Arth. Could you? I'll flee to Northern Ruskin and not care a whit for what happens to Vechel or Perald or even Edelmon. Will you? I won't think twice about all the young lovers and terrified parents and grubby little children fleeing for their lives, or what will happen when they finally run out of places to cower. How many of you can say the same?
The assembled adventurers suddenly took an interest in the astral pattern on Aya's carpet, which was currently being scuffed and dirtied by the collective shuffling of several pairs of booted feet. Heraldin cleared his throat and lifted his hand. His arm was halfway extended when he caught Geist's expression. The weapons master stared at the bard through narrowed eyes. "Well, I might be able to," muttered Heraldin, slowly pulling his hand back.
"I didn't think so,"
said Aya, giving the heroes a stern glare.
"And since you all have consciences or morals or whatever vainglorious term you like for your suicidal tendencies, let's agree you will face the undead sooner or later. And if you're unprepared when you do, well,
The old Noctomancer pounded the crystal on her desk, shattering it.
The guild can take care of the undead, said Gorm.
Ha! The guild.
Aya practically spat the word as she flipped through her folder.
All of these, she added to the shards on her desk.
The air above the shattered crystal shimmered, and the page she was holding lifted from her hand. A second sheaf of parchment, this one blank, glided over as though borne by the wind, and as it did so, writing and sketches burned onto its surface, mirroring the original page hovering near Aya's hand. A moment later, two identical papers settled gently on the desk.
After all you've been through, I can't fathom why you'd trust the guild to deal with a boggart's boil.
Aya tossed another bundle of papers into the air, where weaves of magic quickly swept them up for duplication.
Let me tell you a story about the thrice-cursed guild. Do you remember Tyrannax the Shadowmaster?
The necromancer down in Dalen, recalled Laruna. I heard he wiped out several parties of heroes.
Yes, he was a terror.
Aya watched the paper swirling around her.
Which is why the heroes of Hawksgate petitioned the guild to let them use the Crown of Iron Thorns.
Jin visibly started at the name. The Crown?
You know it? Asked Gorm.
I remember Father talking about it years ago, said Jin.
He possessed it for a time, said Aya.
She reached out and plucked a page from the papery maelstrom swirling around her. It bore an illustration that looked like someone had seen a pile of ship nails and thought it would make a nice hat.
Your father studied the crown for the Leviathan project, and he kept it in the Ashen Tower until Johan took it back for the guild.
But what does it do? Asked Gorm.
It holds great power over the dead, said Aya. So much so that the guild has declared it a Class 1 major artifact.
The assembled heroes broke out in gasps and low whistles. You could fit all the Class 1 artifacts ever discovered into a small room, provided the walls were thick enough and you had a very, very strong lock on the door.
It can't be that powerful, said Heraldin. Hawksgate was almost wiped off the map, as I recall.
The air around Aya was still a swirling storm of paper and ink.
And it wouldn't have been if the heroes defending the city had been given the Crown of Iron Thorns. But the guild just finished processing the paperwork for the request this past summer.
What? Said Caitha. But Tyrannax died 5 years ago.
6,
said Aya. The last of her papers settled into place, leaving two identical piles of parchment sitting next to one another. She placed one stack into a fresh folio.
And by the time they finally went to retrieve the crown, it had gone missing.
Gorm snorted.
How do you lose a thrice-cursed Class 1 artifact?
You don't, said Aya. It gets stolen.
The words hit like a punch in the gut. Gorm glanced at Jin and saw the same unpleasant thought reflected in the Noctomancer's eyes.
And that tells you where we stand, said Aya. The guild is too slow and ponderous to do anything about a threat such as Dhatar, even if they wanted to stop him. They let him steal one of the most powerful artifacts in the world from under their noses. But the right group of people, people with a specific set of skills, people who are already on the wrong side of the law, those people could steal an equally powerful artifact and stop your father.
We're not ready to take on a lich, said Heraldin.
And who better, Master Bard?
Aya smirked.
You've got the famous Pyre Beard here, a warrior without peer, except perhaps the Jade Wind. And what really matters is that you have the young Ermion with you.
All eyes turned to Jin. I've faced my father before. I could not best him, said the Noctomancer quietly.
You did not best him, but that doesn't mean you can't, said Aya sternly. Arth hasn't seen many wizards as gifted as your father, and he only ever trained one apprentice. You and I both know nobody else has a better chance of stopping him, if only you'd let yourself realize your full potential.
Jin's face scrunched up into a grimace.
You presume too much, madam. He snapped.
Aya smirked.
You presume I have other options. I don't know any other heroes nearly as qualified to fight Dattar as your party, and here you are on my doorstep when an hour of great need arises. Well, I've never believed in destiny, but I know opportunity when I see it. You have a chance to stop your father, Jin, provided you have the right information.
She held out the folder of copied documents to the Noctomancer.
And the will to do what's necessary.
The wizard reluctantly lifted the packet from Aya's hands.
You want us to steal artifacts from the guild?
I want to stay alive in a world worth staying alive in. If I have to flee to a new life, I'd rather it not to be alone on an ice floe. I even want it enough to fund your efforts.
Aya pulled a heavy-looking purse from her robes and tossed it at the hero's feet.
And I presume our interests are aligned, since I imagine you want to keep on living and that you'd prefer that as many people as possible do the same. If you want it enough, you might have to steal from the Heroes Guild.
Why should we trust you?
Asked Katha.
You don't have to, said the old Noctomancer. Take some free gold, verify my information if you like, and just, you know.
Aya waved her hand and grimaced.
Do what you were already going to do. Let your conscience be your guide, or something.
Gorm sucked in a deep breath. Nobody wanted to fight the Lich again. The prospect of robbing the guild beforehand didn't make it seem any less crazy. But rescuing innocence from evil was in his bones, and not rescuing innocence from the walking bones would be evil. Plus, Aya was right about the guild's bureaucracy. Just reporting the undead had taken too long. They couldn't react with the speed needed, even if...
Wait.
Gorm looked up at the Counselor of Owls as a thought struck him.
Why wouldn't the guild want to stop a lich?
Oh, they'll want to, eventually.
Aya smirked to herself as she shook her head.
When they think the timing is right. Thrice curse the speculators!
Dwin Poldo exclaimed, flipping through a stack of contracts.
They're the only explanation for this.
Mrs. Herc gave a little shrug and set the letter on Poldo's desk.
I couldn't say, Mr. Poldo, but whatever the reason, Mr. Stern wants you to assemble 5 more CTOs for Southern Ruskin.
Yes, because of the undead, said Poldo, shaking his head.
Someone filed a claim on a big mob of them south of Vetchel earlier this week, and now the speculators are gambling on the threat to Ruskin. That's all these investors are buying. A bet. A risk. An idea.
At least it's good business,
said the gnoll with a hopeful wag of her tail.
No, it's good pay, grumbled Poldo. It's horrible business.
Poldo prepared his threat obligations with all the math and due diligence he could muster, but he had no better idea than anyone how they would perform over their term. Mr. Stern bought them anyway, snapping them up before the ink was dry. The werebear banker spliced and diced the obligations together into CTOs that Fitch invariably rated as triple platinum, even though Poldo wouldn't have called any of them better than tin. But Fitch's word was good enough for the banks and speculators, who seemed to have a bottomless appetite for collateralized threat obligations. Poldo had every reason to be ecstatic, or at least enough reasons to fill a small vault. Yet he couldn't shake the notion that, despite evidence to the contrary, CTOs wouldn't work. That they shouldn't work. They were money from nothing, gold spun from bankers' dreams pressed through impossibly complex equations. The hairs on Poldo's neck stood up when he thought about it for too long.
You're right,
said Mrs. Herc, her tail tucked between her legs.
I'm sorry. I'll get back to tidying the office. I think the plow and shovels could use a good cleaning.
No, I'm sorry, sighed Poldo. I haven't been sleeping enough lately, and it's clearly making me irate. It's been helpful to have you go through the mail.
Mrs. Herc gave a slight smile and continued sifting through the stack of envelopes in front of her. Poldo turned back to his own work. He needed to issue 6 complex threat obligations by tonight, but in the meantime he still had a hedge fund to run. He took a small black box from his desk drawer, and from the box he produced an azure stone inscribed with golden runes. The stone flared with magic when Poldo tapped it 3 times, and the light quickly coalesced into a luminescent blue figure. It glowed so brightly that it looked like a ball of light with a pair of wings. A sprite was a sort of spectral pixie summoned for a specific task, fading away when its job was done. There were sprites for almost everything these days. Sprites for sending messages, sprites for finding things, and sprites for warning of intruders. The glowing figures summoned by Poldo's rather expensive sprite stone, however, were for trade. Poldo consulted his pocket ledger before addressing the tiny, glowing servant.
Silver Guard Securities will place a market order to buy 3,000 shares of the Dragon of Windspar, please. Bye, bye, bye!
The sprite's inner light shifted from sky blue to a bright emerald as it chimed its order maniacally. With a flit of its wings, it zipped to the window, squeezed out through a tiny crack, and ascended into the sky, where it joined the other trade sprites floating from the city's banks and financial offices. They drifted to the great dome of the Andoran Stock Exchange like luminescent moths to a giant golden flame. Once inside, they'd execute their transactions and dutifully expire. Poldo also sold shares of Goldson Bags and Lamia Sisters and bought into a civic bond fund, sending 2 crimson and 1 green sprite out his window. He was pondering his next move when someone knocked at the door, and a moment later Mrs. Herc told him he had a visitor. A lanky human stood on the doorstep in a white jumpsuit covered in muddy smudges and what Poldo hoped were mustard stains. A small white cap perched on his greasy mop of hair, bearing black embroidery in the shape of a dead rat. He gave a friendly wave and nod as Poldo opened the door.
"Hello, Mr. Poldo, sir. I've been hired to exterminate the vermin on your premises, but I'll expect you'll want to be off before I do."
"What?"
said Poldo.
"On account of the noxious cloud, sir."
The exterminator pointed to a wand hanging from his tool belt.
"Makes a nasty gas, it'll wipe out anything in the house. Should dissipate after a few minutes, though. I could do it while you're on your lunch."
"You can't exterminate wood gnomes," said Poldo. "They're protected by law."
"Oh, of course,"
said the exterminator loudly. He gave Poldo a leering wink.
"But, I'm here for the mice."
Poldo's brow furrowed.
"I don't have mice."
Right. But your benefactor, one Mr. Stern, was most emphatic that you do, in fact, have mice. And I can use this wand to get rid of your problem with mice."
The man spoke in the loud, slow pace of someone very stupid who believes he is being very clever. He punctuated each sentence with an exaggerated wink. Poldo grit his teeth and made a mental note to have a frank conversation with Mr. Stern.
"I don't have mice."
The exterminator looked around for help, clearly confused.
"Listen, sure. I'm trying to give you a hint here. I can help you with, you know, your little nuisance."
Poldo was waiting for the word, but he still flinched when he heard it. Few knew better than gnomes how easy it was for the big people to see the smaller ones as annoying, to define them by their convenience, or lack thereof. Most people had seen Mrs. Herc and her pups as nuisances, too. The thought made Poldo's mustache bristle.
"I am also trying to give you a hint. The only nuisance I need to be rid of is the big one standing in my doorway."
The message finally breached the exterminator's thick skull. He gave a frown and a sniff.
"Well, I know where I'm not wanted."
"I suspect that makes you an expert on geography," snapped Poldo.
He managed to growl, "Good day, sir," before slamming the door in the exterminator's face. It took a moment to find his composure again. When Poldo turned around, Mrs. Herc was staring at him with an odd smile.
"I'm sorry you had to see that," he said, adjusting his tie.
"You're a good man, Mr. Poldo," said the gnoll.
Poldo wasn't used to receiving compliments that didn't have hard figures attached to them, so he simply nodded as he returned to his desk. Once there, though, he noticed that Mrs. Herc was still watching him, though now with a face that seemed a little more pensive.
"Is something wrong, Mrs. Herc?" he asked.
"No, no,"
said Mrs. Herc, turning back to the stack of unopened mail.
"It's nothing." "I'm sure it isn't,"
Poldo said.
"It's just, I don't feel right asking something of you when you've done so much for the children and I."
Mrs. Herc knit her paws together anxiously as she spoke.
I was talking to Barga of the Firehawk tribe last night, and she and her mate were evicted from their apartment last week. I know she'll find a new job soon, but it's hard for a goblin these days, even with a good record and clean NPC papers.
Poldo could see where this was going.
And you'd like for them to stay with us? It would only be for a little while, said the gnoll, just until she finds work in a new apartment. The guild will rescind her family's papers if they find them living on the streets, and there's only one other option for Shadowkin these days.
Poldo nodded. He knew where undocumented Shadowkin would wind up.
The Red Horde!
Bellowed Darek Guzvarda, his great warhammer held high. He wore the ceremonial armor of a chieftain, with the new addition of a crimson pauldron on his left shoulder.
The Red Horde! The crowd roared back at him. The Red Horde! The Red Horde!
They were still shouting it as Darek strode off the stage built for his coronation. Ashurzu barely recognized her little brother, standing taller than even father had, draped in beads and slathered in a chieftain's ceremonial skin paint. He looked like the kind of chieftain orcs sang ballads about, a mighty warrior striding out of legends of blood and valor. With a figure so imposing, it was no wonder that Darek had claimed the throne unopposed. Yet in his eyes, Ashurzu saw only sadness and fear.
"You do not look happy, my sister," said Darek, managing a smile.
"Nor do you, honored one," she said.
"Do not call me that," he grumbled.
He joined Ashurzu in the shadows behind the stage and leaned against the same fence that she did. The wooden barrier groaned in protest.
"Not when it is just you and I. I never wanted that."
"I did not think you wanted any of this,"
Ashurzu said softly. She stared out at the homes of the Guzvarda beyond the fence, a village of huts, tents, and makeshift hovels by the rocky coast. The archway holding Fulgen's Rest formed a dark silhouette against the deepening evening.
"The warriors are celebrating," said Darek. "They wished to see me follow Brother Char's path, and I have. I will honor him."
"And what of father?" asked Ashurzu. "What of his ways? Or what of the people? Not all are warriors. Not all wish to join the Red Horde."
I will try the best I can," said Darek, looking about as though cornered. "I wish to honor father and you and Char and all of the others. But I don't always... I mean, how do you honor them all?"
"You alone must choose who to listen to and whose counsel to take," said Ashurzu.
"I do not know if I can," Darek admitted.
"You can,"
Ashurzu set her hand atop her brother's.
"You must. You are chieftain now. And I will be with you, little warg, no matter what."
He smiled down at her, but couldn't say anything. They waited together until after the celebration had ended, staring out at the hovels of the Guzvarda as the fire pits winked out one by one.